We are continuing with the reactivity of carbonyl-containing compounds, aldehydes, and ketones. So last time we had talked about imines and enamines. There were a couple of things in that topic that we didn't quite have time to cover. One of them was the Wolff-Kishner reduction. I know that's one of the things listed for that day, so we need to backtrack and cover that, along with some close relatives of imines that form exactly under the same mechanism, and I'm speaking specifically of oximes and hydrazones. So we've got a small number of functional groups we've got to tackle this morning. Then we're supposed to be coming to the Grignard reaction, which we've already seen an overview of it, but I want to go over a little more detail or a few synthetic examples of the Grignard reaction, because it's going to be the most important synthetic reaction that we learn all quarter. So let's go back to imine and enamines. And as a review, could someone tell me why is it that when we react an aldehyde with a primary amine with some kind of weak acid source, we get the imine and not this enamine? Why one, not the other? Yes?
Is it because the amine has two hydrogen in the nitrogen, so this molecule has twice in the carbon?
So the fact that the nitrogen has two hydrogens, so it's able to react twice. Mm-hmm. I see. That is correct. What's another reason? Because both of these mechanisms on paper are possible. But why is it that only the first of those products gets formed? The answer is thermodynamics. And what I would advise you to do, and realize that's teacher language for, I'm thinking about this for the test already. So what I would advise you to do is maybe go through and do an analysis. See which bonds are broken and which ones are formed as you go from one compound to the next. So if we look at what gets destroyed going in from left to right, we have a carbon-nitrogen bond broken. What else do we have? We have a nitrogen-hydrogen bond formed. We have a carbon-hydrogen bond broken. And we have a carbon-carbon double bond formed. Overall, it's an endothermic process. Delta H is greater than zero. So the reason that the second product doesn't form is it's not thermodynamically favorable. But what Fenn said about mechanism, the fact that the original amine has two removable hydrogens on it, that is why it can form an imine. Because we looked at a separate example where you could take a ketone, and it's not the fact that it's a ketone or aldehyde that's important. I'm just switching between substrates to just show different examples. But if I reacted this with a secondary amine, and H plus, then her point would be very correct that there's only one removable hydrogen, which means the only reasonable product that will form is the enamine. So this is just a review of the two main functional groups we saw Friday, imines and enamines. What is the relationship between these two? If we did convert from one to the other, what is that process called? Tautomerization. Now moving on with a little new material. There's a very reactive molecule called hydrazine, which is as if you took two amines and fused them directly together. Hydrazine and many nitrogen-containing compounds, in fact, are used as fuels. Well, hydrazine, if you react with a weak acid source and a carbonyl, then you form what looks like an imine, except that off of the nitrogen, we do have this second nitrogen group. So from a hydrazine, we form a group called a hydrazone. And hydrazones are found in a number of applications. One of them, which we'll discuss later in the quarter, is the formation of what's called a derivative, not the same as in a math application, but where we form a related compound which we can use to do an alternate form of characterization. If you think back to the time when maybe you only had melting point as one of your main analytic tools, well, lots of compounds have the same melting point. But what if you could make a derivative of that compound? And you also had a table of different derivatives that different compounds make. Well, by taking a compound and one or more derivatives and matching not just the compound, but those derivatives' melting points, well, then you could more accurately figure out what the identity of your compound is. Hydrazones can also be used to synthesize specific classes of compounds. They also could be used in this thing called the Wolff-Kishner reduction. I think this is one of those versions of Wolff that does have two Fs. So the Wolff-Kishner reduction is the base reduction of a hydrazone. And we'll go ahead and use this one made from acetone as my example that I'll write the mechanism for. Mechanism requires concentrated hydroxide and heat, so it's not compatible with all functional groups. I'm pointing this out because we do have this idea of a protecting group that you've been introduced to. And so I want you to start thinking about compatibility of acids and bases with different functional groups as I present them. Now, this hydrazone in base, it's not favorable, but what can happen over time is you could have a deprotonation. And I'm going to go ahead and write this with reversible arrows because it technically is an equilibrium process. And what we make when we deprotonate it, though, is a delocalized anion, because we do have a double bond next door that I could show as delocalizing that negative charge. Which formally would now make a carbanion, which could attack water. Where does the water come from? Well, even if you were in a non-aqueous solution, we just used hydroxide as a reagent. It just deprotonated something, so we just made water. Notice, and I know this is a comment I made before, but common enough problem, that's why I'm commenting again. I did not use H plus at this point, because there is no H plus in a basic solution. No appreciable amount of H plus, at least. So, I've now made a nitrogen-nitrogen double bond. From the hydrazone to this point, what is this process called? I've yet again just done an exchange of a double and single bond. It's yet again tautomerization. Oh, sorry. I don't think I did that either. Do I have some other button? So, what happens next? Similar thing. Yet another hydrogen gets deprotonated. And we could show delocalization again. But notice in this case, I had been using reversible arrows up to this point. I'm now showing an irreversible arrow. And that's because in this process, we make nitrogen gas, which just bubbles away. Since it bubbles away, it's not at all possible for it to be a reversible mechanism. So once you get to this point, you can't go backwards. We make a carb anion, which is very, very basic. And so you'd have a rapid neutralization with water to form an alkane. So I know some time ago I stopped going over those six aspects of a reaction every time that we did a new reaction, just because we have so many reactions we're covering now. But the synthetic utility of this reaction would be to convert an aldehyde or a ketone to an alkane. So you're reducing, but you're completely getting rid of the oxygen. So there are other techniques that can do this, but this could be a useful one as long as you have something that's base compatible. And if you look at it, it really is, in a sense, almost a double tautomerization. The second one isn't really a tautomerization because we don't end up with exchange of bonds, but it starts out the same way. So questions on this? Yes?
Is it the synthetic utility is on turning aldehydes to alkanes?
That's right.
So can we use on ketones as well?
Yes, aldehydes and ketones. And let me write that out. And, of course, there's an intermediate step where we make the hydrazone out of that aldehyde and ketone first. But overall, then, that's the utility. Now, one last related item. Common name for this compound I'm about to show you is hydroxylamine. Which, let's not get into why is it hydroxyl versus hydroxy. Let me just say it has to do with nitrogen nomenclature. But this hydroxylamine, the nitrogen is more nucleophilic than the oxygen. And so if we reacted this dual functional molecule with a ketone or aldehyde, we'll have yet again the same kind of mechanism that we saw on Friday. Which is the same mechanism that would make a hydrazone. We get the same kind of intermediate, where it's nitrogen with a double bond, except unlike a hydrazone, where we had an amine hanging off of the nitrogen, now we have this hydroxide group hanging off a nitrogen. This is a functional group known as an oxime, which I'm not as familiar with why oximes are useful, but I know they are used in certain reactions. But common enough question that comes up, what is one? You should know it. So questions about hydrazones, oximes, the Wolff-Kishner reduction, or anything that we covered last week dealing with imines or enamines? Yes?
Do
Not yet. No. Next quarter, when we talk about amines, we'll see one of those applications. All right, then, let's go ahead and switch over to talking about Grignard reactions. So first, some notes about mechanism. Grignard reaction is kind of a famous example of a reaction for which a concrete mechanism has not been completely determined, at least as of the writing of the various textbooks that I checked through, which kind of confirmed the same thing I learned back when I was an undergraduate student. They know sort of what happens in the reaction, but they haven't been able to conclusively prove one way or another exactly what goes on. And that's both for the formation of the Grignard reagent and of the Grignard reaction itself. So first, for Grignard reagents, the first step of the reaction is thought to be between magnesium metal and the halogen of whatever alkyl halide gets involved. I'm going to write this much like I wrote the sodium reduction of alkynes last quarter. If you remember, sodium metal, it's a good reducing agent because it has a low ionization energy. And in ammonia liquid, the sodium metal acts as a source of electrons. And in the first step of the reduction of an alkyne, an electron gets added into the triple bond coming out of solution. Essentially, the same thing happens here, where magnesium metal provides an electron, effectively reducing the alkyl halide. But where's that electron going to go? Because don't we already have a bond between carbon and bromine? So if, which this is one of the things they think might be happening, if an electron gets added in, we actually create a structure for which we can't write the full structure for. There are three electrons in that bond, which means really there's only a half bond there. Now, because if you already have a bond, you put another electron in. If you think about molecular orbital theory, whenever two orbitals come together and we make a sigma bond, we make a sigma antibond at the same time. It's just that normally we only have two electrons, so only the bonding part of it gets filled. The antibond stays empty. Well, if we now make this radical anion, that is destabilizing the bond, if we allow that bond to open, we're now going to create a radical and a bromide. We also have magnesium plus that's floating around because an electron came from it. Well, that magnesium and bromide, they could react to make a magnesium bromide radical. Plus, we have the alkyl radical. Those two combine. And we make our Grignard reagent. I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to be asking for this mechanism on an exam. Because this is one proposed mechanism. Because it's not truly known which way it works, not going to quiz you on it, but I just want to show you that it's a radical process, or thought to be radical process, and, well, it's got a number of interesting steps. Yes.
In the second step, I don't get what kind of bond is between bromine and
carbon? A half bond is there, which there is no good way to notate it, and that's what that little bracket up above means. It means in addition to what the structure is showing you, there is one extra electron, which is making the whole thing overall negatively charged.
So there is a carbon bond.
There is a carbon-bromine bond there, that's right. And when it breaks, one electron goes back to the carbon, that's why it ends up a radical. One electron goes back to bromine. But there's actually yet another electron there, which is what's being shown by the bracket. So that's why bromine ends up with a lone pair, ends up negatively charged. Otherwise, normally if bromine broke homolytically, meaning one electron going to each side of the bond, bromine would end up neutrally charged because it would have only seven electrons. But it's more electronegative than carbon, so it's ending up with that yet extra electron, which is why it's negatively charged. Yeah.
Where's the bromine, magnesium has the electron?
Because magnesium has two valence electrons. And we used one up in the redox, so there's one more left. Yeah.
So in for bromine, can't they just expand their shell and then accept that electron?
But it goes into the bond. It's reducing the bond. That's how the reaction starts. Or even if it went to the bromine, the expansion of an octet of an element below the second row of the periodic table is not necessarily going straight into a d orbital. There's a more complicated interaction there that we just don't teach in general chem normally. So no, it's not just getting absorbed by the bromine. Yeah. Magnesium can form 2+. But it hasn't released two electrons necessarily in this process.
So the resulting molecule is neutral?
It is. But it acts like it's the anion. And it may have been created in a radical process, but it acts like it's an anion. Yeah?
So in the real life, the mechanism has to be proven?
It doesn't have to be proven. It would be nice to know what a mechanism is, so if we wanted to modify a reaction. But we don't always know mechanisms, no. Yes?
Is PR energy forms like a complex or is ionic?
The magnesium and the bromine together?
Yeah.
I don't know what by itself it looks like.
So are they separate or they are attached?
They're attached. What exactly the nature of that bond is, I don't know. Organometallic chemistry is not my expertise. Because there is one valence electron effectively left on magnesium. If there were two originally and we only got rid of one, there's one left over. No, you're asking these questions because this is a very confusing looking reaction. It's nothing like what you've seen before, and you haven't used metal centers. So your questions are very natural. I just don't happen to have all the answers because to some of these questions there aren't answers even. But no, magic, that's right.
Magic.
Yes. Which I have not used as a reagent yet, but you never know.
Have you used it?
I have actually let people use that before to simplify what really goes on when I say it doesn't matter what goes on. But I have not actually used magic as a reagent, and you may only use those reagents that I've taught you in an exam. So no magic yet. Harry Potter or otherwise. Yes? Miracle, yes. Well, no, but you got to be careful because as the ACS members know, there is this thing called miraculin. It's a protein. So, but I don't think that's going to be used on your exams either. How about we actually see what happens with the Grignard reaction? Or how about more importantly, we cover those things about Grignard reagents you really need to know, like the fact that you have to have ether or THF to form them. I know that we reviewed that already, but I want to put one last time in the notes so there's no chance that you can say, I didn't know that. Grignard reagents will only successfully form if an ether is present, to complex with the magnesium. And the other day I already wrote out furan and talked about THF as a derivative of furan, correct? Because I also then did pyran when we talked about protecting groups and show how adding to it is how we get DHP and THP. Now there's some other things I want you to know about Grignard reagents. Since we are going to be starting the Grignard reaction, well, Wednesday, which section two, section one, some people did their pre-labs, some didn't. I know that I had said that you should be doing your pre-labs according to your schedule. If you didn't have it for today, though, it was fine because I know that you've got the second day of lab three that you need to be doing. But if you did look ahead to experiment four, those of you who did do your pre-labs, you know that there's some glassware that you need to have ready and put in the oven to be ready to walk in next time and start the lab. When we come in next time, I'm going to do another just very tiny pre-lab. And in fact, because of the timing of this Grignard reaction, I haven't fully decided this yet, but very likely your lab quiz will be moved to Wednesday of next week instead of Monday, because I won't really have the time to review for your lab quiz this Wednesday, because you have to finish the Grignard preparation and reaction in one day or it won't work. Because the Grignard reagent you can't keep around. In fact, that's the lead-in to the next part of the story here, is what are the ways that Grignard reagents can be destroyed? Like, what things must you keep the Grignard reagent from in order to make sure that the reaction works? So, let's cover that. So Grignard reagents can be destroyed by water or any protic compound. And we could take advantage of that to do deuteration, because instead of H2O, we could use D2O. So for example, if we had an alkyl halide that we reacted with magnesium and ether, we could make the alkyl magnesium halide, react it with D2O, and where the halogen had been, we'll now have a deuterium. So that's one productive use of destroying a Grignard reagent. But just in general, if you have water around, which even means the water that potentially is always absorbed on the surface of glass, that you're going to kill off some of your Grignard reagent. And so that's why you're supposed to prep your glassware today, get it into the oven, to make sure that you dehydrate it as much as possible so that as you're doing the reaction, it doesn't just get instantly killed off. Another thing that destroys Grignard reagents, carbon dioxide, which sometimes, again, is taken advantage of, that you do the destruction on purpose. Because carbon dioxide, if you get it in the form of dry ice, well, that's a very easy substrate physically to do a Grignard reaction on. Because you can prepare the Grignard reagent, and, well, not literally, but pour it over dry ice. Instantly reacts to make what? Well, can make the Grignard reagent, react it with CO2. CO2 is just a double carbonyl. And so if you were to write out what happens mechanistically, you'd end up with a carboxylate. If you do the subsequent H plus workup, that means you've got a carboxylic acid. So it's a way of easily making carboxylic acids. Yes?
Is that the most favorable reaction if you add CO2 there?
Favorable in what sense?
Is that the most product that you're forming?
It's just one type of Grignard reaction. It's an easy one in the sense that you've got a solid that you can add it to. Grignard reactions are very, very, very exothermic. Dry ice is really cold. So you got a solid that's cold makes a good reaction, just in a physical sense, performing the reaction. It's easier to do, or it's kind of interesting to do with one of these dry ice types.
Now the.
Well, you can't go direct. Oh, you mean over-oxidize an aldehyde? It kind of depends on your situation. So the question was, would you want to do an approach like this to make a carboxylic acid, or would you want to use over-oxidation using a chromium reagent on a primary alcohol? Depends on the cost of the reagents and which one ends up being more difficult to do in real life. So on a case-by-case basis, one might be better, the other might be better. So, and there's many other ways that we'll learn that we can make carboxylic acids as well. And so that's a challenge actually in organic chemistry for synthesis is maybe you got 10 ways to do it, but which one's best? Yeah. Did I? 1, 2, 3, I did, sorry. Let's make sure the product, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Notice there is one more in the product. That one's correct because carbon dioxide itself has carbon in it. So I should have added a carbon. Yes. Yes. Carbon monoxide? Ooh, I presume so, but it's a more minor component of the atmosphere anyway, so we're not usually as worried about it. The other thing that we're more worried about is oxygen. Well, I guess humans aren't worried by oxygen, but kind of addicted to the stuff, actually. But it will form, well, once it gets protonated, it will form a peroxide. So all three of these must be avoided in order to make sure that your Grignard reagent doesn't decompose. So Grignard reagents are ideally formed in flame-dried or oven-dried glassware. And this is a phrase that we don't use much in this class, but it is true. Under inert atmosphere, which means fill up your reaction chamber with a gas that's non-reactive, like nitrogen or argon. Those are the two most common cases. Nitrogen gas isn't so unusual to have in an organic lab. We don't happen to have any of our own cells. So we won't be taking as much precaution as we could. But given our equipment and resources, we're doing the best that we can. Yes?
So in our experiment, we just excluded water?
We're trying to exclude water, so that's why we're heating up the glassware.
But it still reacts with CO2 and O2.
That's right. But we're going to be doing, as soon as we make the Grignard reagent and we know that we've made it, we're going to immediately react it. So we're going to try to minimize the amount of time it's just sitting around with the potential to decompose. Since, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 2, 4, 6, 8, 30, 2, 4, 6, 8. Wait a minute, hold on. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 2, 4, 6, 8, 30, 2, 4, 6, 8, 4, 39?
Ooh.
Well, there should be 50 in here, right? Because we haven't had that many drops, and even though Kevin's asleep over there, poor Kevin. No, because it's going to be bad enough when he hears the recording later. Well, I was going to say, hopefully everybody was here to hear these announcements, because since we're talking about Grignard reagents, and since it is such a time-sensitive lab, I'm going to flip over to lab lecture for just a moment, which I know I don't normally do in here, so it's kind of unusual. But let's talk about the Grignard reaction. Yes?
Why do you always use primary alkyl halide?
Because they're quicker to write.
Oh,
Oh, it's certainly possible to do secondary or tertiary. No, perfectly valid question. No, because one of the things that drives people the most crazy at some point in 12B, it's like, okay, if you give me the same example on the exam that we did in class, I could do the problem, but you put one more methyl group on there and I'm lost. But that's important to recognize, that you need to find the patterns and not memorize just for particular molecules, right? Have you all already said that? You think, how did you know I was saying that? Anyways, to the lab. Here's the way that the reaction is going to work. You're going to start out with solid magnesium metal. The best way to get the reaction going is to ignore the directions. Because here's what goes on. The alkyl halide has to eat through magnesium oxide. Magnesium oxide is what you get when magnesium metal just reacts with oxygen. Which brings up another point, which, since no one else is going to be here yet this morning, I might as well announce it now. Section one, why is it there's magnesium metal spread out around the balance area right now? Section one, why are there salt plates out? Why are the IR holders out and still have samples in them? I guess that because I was absorbed in doing things on the computer today, you thought I didn't pay any attention to what was going on in the lab or didn't go around checking up afterwards. Last week, section one, why was it that 50% sodium hydroxide was just spilt on the inside of one of the fume hoods with the little pipette still sitting in the puddle of the sodium hydroxide, which I realized after I picked it up that because my hands were slippery. Now, section two, I think you already heard me whining about this because section one had done it in the morning, but section one hadn't heard me whine about it yet because they already had left. But section one, I already informed sections two and three that they didn't get any more warnings this quarter, that if I came like I did afterwards and found that kind of mess, they would just already have lost the points on their lab reports. And I hope that section one, you remember at the beginning of the quarter, I said that if we ended up in this situation, that's exactly what I would do. So I'll turn that back around. I don't care what your lab schedules or lecture schedules the rest of the day are, but somebody from section one better show up during my lab lecture and clean up that mess, or you're all losing points today. Because just because I'm not on top of you every single second doesn't mean that you're not still responsible for keeping the lab clean. That doesn't change, even if I look I'm in my own world, that doesn't change your own responsibility. Makes it even more important, therefore, that I come back from my own world every once in a while and check what the lab looks like, which I did. It wasn't good. So I'm just letting you all know, it better be clean by the time that lab two starts their lab, or there's going to be problems. Lab two, you don't get a warning. If the lab's a mess when the lab's over today, I just decide how many points to take off. Y'all can't keep acting like this. You shouldn't have to have me come around with, like, a video camera after each one of you. You know, I don't need to be a red light camera. You know, that's not my job, per se. It is if I have to be, but I don't like to have to be. It's not necessary. So I know that you're all in a rush to clean up, but really, why was the stuff left at the balance? Does anybody have a good reason? No. So, don't do it. Because now, there will be the consequences. And I'm serious. If I'm done with lab lecture and there's still magnesium and the salt plates are still out, points are coming off. So somebody better give. And I don't want to have to be the same person that's going around a lab cleaning every time either. If that's happening, that's just as bad. So, I thought of that because I was talking about the magnesium for this reaction. Which I'll now come back to, now that you've had your warning, your last one. The magnesium reacts in air to make magnesium oxide. The alkyl halide has to eat through that in order for the reaction to start. Once the reaction starts and it gets through that outside layer, it's exothermic and will happen quickly. But it's that initiation of a Grignard reaction that's famously difficult. So the real way we should do this, the ideal way, is we have very finely powdered magnesium, activated magnesium, that's just ready to react with the alkyl halide. Sometimes what people will do is put a few drops of the alkyl halide in with just a little bit of solvent, and not stir it. Not stir it. So that the alkyl halide, which is more dense, will drop down, drop to the bottom, react, and sit there on that magnesium metal, eat through the magnesium metal, start the reaction. How do you know the reaction started? Little fine itty-bitty bubbles, which you have to make sure you distinguish from heating up the ether. You know, ether has a very low boiling point. But what you'll see are these little, like, imagine you had 7-Up or something that was sitting in there. Little itty-bitty tiny bubbles coming from the surface of that magnesium metal. You'll also notice the solution starting to turn cloudy because you're making something that has an ionic component to it. Or as soon as it starts reacting with the water or carbon dioxide you're not able to keep out, you're going to be making byproducts which make the solution cloudy. It'll also probably turn color, so it'll probably turn brownish because of whatever halide that we happen to have around. Now, what can you do to get a Grignard reaction working that refuses to get started? Well, there's a couple of tricks, which I don't know if either of them are mentioned in your procedure. One is to add a small crystal of iodine. And you put that right into the middle of where the magnesium is. The iodine is kind of like the alkyl halide. It reacts with the magnesium. Of course, it doesn't give you a Grignard reagent, but magnesium's cheap, so we usually use it in excess. That's another way that you'll know that the Grignard reaction is working, because the magnesium will look like it's disappearing. But remember that we are using an excess of magnesium, so it's not necessarily going to totally disappear. But go ahead and follow the procedure. This means you better really have your prelabs prepared for Wednesday. But you'll follow the procedure as is, but just recognize that instead of keep on adding material or keep on stirring, you might want to turn the stirrer off and just let stuff sit for a little bit. And after 5, 10, or 15 minutes, if you don't see any reaction whatsoever, even with a little bit of heating, you might add that little crystal of iodine. You might add a little more of just what's called neat. Neat in chemistry means pure, 100% no solvent. You might add some neat alkyl halide, and again, just let it sit there. In real life, with larger quantities, you've got to be really careful doing that. Because you could throw all the alkyl halide in it. But then once the Grignard reaction starts, it's exothermic, and with larger reactions, it usually will go shooting out of the reaction flask because of how hot it all of a sudden gets. And of course, if you got ether there that's got a low ignition temperature, heat plus ether equals bad news. Now, the other way to do this, which of course is not, this is a horrible way to do it if you care about the cost of reagents or trying to get away with doing clean stoichiometry, is you could throw the alkyl halide by itself in a little test tube with a little thing of magnesium, have the reaction start directly between the two, and I'm talking just a few drops worth so it doesn't get out of control thermally. Then transfer that whole thing into the flask, because sometimes if you can get the reaction initiated and put it into another reaction that hasn't started yet, you can sometimes kickstart the reaction. Grignard reactions are famously difficult. So I'm just telling you all of this so that you could be as prepared as possible on Wednesday. Now, after all that, do we have questions? Then the, yes? Is the quiz on Wednesday? There's plenty of material to put on a quiz. But considering I haven't finished grading the exams yet, I need some more time to grade. So Monday, no way. Friday. We'll move the quiz to Friday. Now, don't you all pack up. We've got 6 minutes left of this class. Wow. I think one thing, no matter what else you might say about me, I don't think anybody's ever said, man, he didn't talk enough. So, how about identifying the reagents used in a Grignard reaction if we only see the product? You know, a little synthesis practice. In other words, take about 30 seconds and determine for me what the starting materials might have been in the Grignard reaction that made this alcohol. So in other words, I'm asking this. Well, write them down. And I'm saying specifically, though, a Grignard reaction. So not just a reduction, not just whatever. Specifically, Grignard reaction. Which, what could have happened to make that alcohol? So there's two observations about Grignard reactions you need to make. One is that the alcohol will be at the carbon that used to contain the carbonyl. And if you knew the mechanism, you might say, well, of course. But no, that's really important. That's what lets you back up retrosynthetically and figure out what used to be there. So in this specific example, there is a carbonyl that used to be here, but on one of the two compounds involved. And so here's the second part to this. The new carbon-carbon bond must contain the carbon that was part of the carbonyl. Well, we put these two statements together. What does that let us determine as far as likely candidates for the starting materials of this reaction? Well, here is a carbon-carbon bond that includes the carbon where the alcohol is, which in statement one means that's the carbon that used to contain the carbonyl. Well, what if I broke the carbon-carbon bond apart? Then we could have had phenyl magnesium bromide as the Grignard reagent, and propanol as the substrate that was attacked. Or, here's another carbon-carbon bond that again must have had contained that carbonyl. If I break the compound up that way, that means I now have benzaldehyde that could have been my substrate, and it could have been ethyl magnesium bromide that's my Grignard reagent. Which way would have worked? Yes. There's nothing wrong with either of these methods. All of those compounds are very commonly available, very easily made. Methyl magnesium bromide could be made from bromobenzene, benzaldehyde. Well, okay. There's a real life problem with benzaldehyde, which is because of all the drug trade, they figured out all these different synthetic routes for making ecstasy and all these other things that benzaldehyde, unfortunately, is sometimes used as a precursor for. So even though it's a perfectly usable reagent all over the place in synthetic chemistry, it's a little bit harder to buy. Because you need special licenses, because they want to know that you're not going to just be the next version of Breaking Bad. So, In paper, though, there's nothing wrong with either of these syntheses. So what I guess we'll do, since we don't have the quiz on Wednesday, and I told you already that I wanted to do more synthesis practice, is we'll start Wednesday off with a little bit of synthesis practice before we go into the lecture topic. So we're out of time. I've got office hours at 2:25. Section 2, I'm going to be a couple of minutes late to lab. And if I could have a volunteer to help move my audio equipment over.